This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Gemma Blythe. The History of England, from the Accession of James II, by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Chapter 6, Part 1. James was now at the height of power and prosperity. Both in England and in Scotland, he had vanquished his enemies and had punished them with a severity which had indeed excited their bitterest hatred, and had, at the same time, effectually quelled their courage. The Whig party seemed extinct. The name of Whig was never used except as a term of reproach. The Parliament was devoted to the King, and it was in his power to keep that Parliament to the end of his reign. The Church was louder than ever in professions of attachment to him, and had, during the late insurrection, acted up to those professions. The judges were his tools, and if they ceased to be so, it was in his power to remove them. The corporations were filled with his creatures. His revenues far exceeded those of his predecessors. His pride rose high. He was not the same man who, a few months before, in doubt whether his throne might not be overturned in an hour, had implored foreign help with unkingly supplications, and had accepted it with tears of gratitude. Visions of dominion and glory rose before him. He already saw himself, in imagination, the umpire of Europe, the champion of many states oppressed by one too powerful monarchy. So early in the month of June, he had assured the United Provinces that as soon as the affairs of England were settled, he would show the world how little he feared France. In conformity with these assurances, he, within a month after the Battle of Sedgemoor, concluded with the States General a defensive treaty, framed in the very spirit of the Triple League. It was regarded, both at the Hague and at Versailles, as the most significant circumstance that Halifax, who was the constant and mortal enemy of French ascendancy, and who had scarcely ever before been consulted on any grave affair since the beginning of the reign, took the lead on this occasion and seemed to have the royal ear. It was a circumstance not less significant that no previous communication was made to Barillon. Both he and his master were taken by surprise. Louis was much troubled and expressed great and not unreasonable anxiety as to the ulterior designs of the prince, who had lately been his pensioner and vassal. There were strong rumors that William of Orange was busied in organizing a great confederacy, which was to include both branches of the House of Austria, the United Provinces, the Kingdom of Sweden, and the electorate of Brandenburg. It now seemed that this confederacy would have at its head the King and Parliament of England. In fact, negotiations tending to such a result were actually opened. Spain proposed to form a close alliance with James, and he listened to the proposition with favor. Though it was evident that such an alliance would be a little less than a declaration of war against France, but he postponed his final decision till after the Parliament should have reassembled. The fate of Christendom depended on the temper in which he might then find the Commons. If they were disposed to acquiesce in his plans of domestic government, there would be nothing to prevent him from interfering with vigor and authority in the great dispute which must soon be brought to an issue on the Continent. If they were refractory, he must relinquish all thoughts of arbitrating between contending nations, must again implore French assistance, must again submit to French dictation, must sink into a potentate of the third or fourth class, and must indemnify himself for the contempt with which he would be regarded abroad by triumphs over law and public opinion at home. It seemed, indeed, that it would not be easy for him to demand more than the Commons were disposed to give. Already they had abundantly proved that they were desirous to maintain his prerogatives unimpaired, and that they were by no means extreme to mark his encroachments on the rights of the people. Indeed, 11/12 of the members were either dependents of the court, or zealous cavaliers from the country. There were few things which such an assembly could pertinaciously refuse to the sovereign, and happily for the nation, those few things were the very things on which James had set his heart. One of his objects was to obtain a repeal of the Habeas Corpus Act, which he hated, as it was natural that a tyrant should hate the most stringent curb that ever legislation imposed on tyranny. This feeling remained deeply fixed in his mind to the last, and appears in the instructions which he drew up in exile for the guidance of his son. But the Habeas Corpus Act, which passed during the ascendancy of the Whigs, was not more dear to the Whigs than to the Tories. It is indeed not wonderful that this great law should be highly prized by all Englishmen, without distinction of party, for it is a law which, not by circuitous, but by direct operation, adds to the security and happiness of every inhabitant of the realm. James had yet another design, odious to the party which had set him on the throne, and which had upheld him there. He wished to form a great standing army. He had taken advantage of the late insurrection to make large additions to the military force which his brother had left. The bodies now designated as the 1st 6 regiments of Dragoon Guards, the 3rd and 4th regiments of Dragoons, and the 9th regiments of infantry of the line, from the 7th to the 15th inclusive, had just been raised. The effect of these augmentations and of the recall of the garrison of Tangier was that the number of regular troops in England had, in a few months, been increased from 6,000 to near 20,000. No English king had ever, in time of peace, had such a force at his command. Yet even with this force, James was not content. He often repeated that confidence could be placed in the fidelity of the train bands, that they sympathized with all the passions of the class to which they belonged, that at Sedgemoor there had been more militiamen in the rebel army than in the royal encampment, and that, if the throne had been defended only by the array of the counties, Monmouth would have marched in triumph from Lyme to London. The revenue, large as it was when compared with that of former kings, barely sufficed to meet this new charge. A great part of the produce of the new taxes was absorbed by the naval expenditure. At the close of the late reign, the whole cost of the army, the Tangier regiments included, had been under £300,000 a year. £600,000 a year would not now suffice. If any further augmentation were made, it would be necessary to demand a supply from Parliament, and it was not likely that Parliament would be in a complying mood. The very name of standing army was hateful to the whole nation, and to no part of the nation more hateful than to the cavalier gentlemen who filled the lower house. In their minds, a standing army was inseparably associated with the rump, with the protector, with the spoliation of the church, with the purgation of the universities, with the abolition of the peerage, with the murder of the king, with the sullen reign of the saints, with Kant and asceticism, with fines and sequestrations, with the insults which major generals, sprung from the dregs of the people, had offered to the oldest and most honorable families of the kingdom. There was, moreover, scarcely a baronet or a squire in the Parliament who did not owe part of his importance in his own county to his rank in the militia. If that national force were set aside, the gentry of England must lose much of their dignity and influence. It was therefore probable that the king would find it more difficult to obtain funds for the support of his army than even to obtain the repeal of the Habeas Corpus Act. But both the designs which have been mentioned were subordinate to one great design on which the king's whole soul was bent, but which was abhorred by those Tory gentlemen who were ready to shed their blood for his rights, abhorred by that church which had never, during 3 generations of civil discord, wavered in fidelity to his house, abhorred even by that army on which, in the last extremity, he must rely. His religion was still under proscription. Many rigorous laws against Roman Catholics appeared on the statute book, and had, within no long time, been rigorously executed. The Test Act excluded from civil and military office all who dissented from the Church of England, and, by a subsequent act, passed when the fictions of Oates had driven the nation wild, it had been provided that no person shall sit in either House of Parliament without solemnly abjuring the doctrine of transubstantiation. That the king should wish to obtain for the church, to which he belonged, a complete toleration was natural and right. Nor is there any reason to doubt that, by a little patience, prudence, and justice, such a toleration might have been obtained. The extreme antipathy and dread with which the English people regarded his religion was not to be ascribed solely or chiefly to theological animosity. That salvation might be found in the Church of Rome, nay, that some members of that church had been among the brightest examples of Christian virtue, was admitted by all divines of the Anglican communion and by the most illustrious nonconformists. It is notorious that the penal codes against popery were strenuously defended by many who thought Arianism, Quakerism, and Judaism more dangerous in a spiritual point of view than popery, and who had yet showed no disposition to enact similar laws against Arians, Quakers, or Jews. It is easy to explain why the Roman Catholic was treated with less indulgence than was shown to men who renounced the doctrine of the Nicene Fathers, and even to men who had not been admitted by baptism within the Christian pale. There was among the English a strong conviction that the Roman Catholic, where the interests of his religion were concerned, thought himself free from all the ordinary rules of morality, nay, that he thought it meritorious to violate those rules if, by so doing, he could avert injury or reproach from the church of which he was a member. Nor was this opinion destitute of a show of reason. It was impossible to deny that Roman Catholic casuists of great eminence were written in defense of equivocation, of mental reservation, of perjury, and even of assassination. Nor, it was said, had the speculations of this odious school of sophists been barren of results. The massacre of St. Bartholomew, the murder of the first William of Orange, the murder of Henry III of France, the numerous conspiracies which had been formed against the life of Elizabeth, and above all, the gunpowder treason, were constantly cited as instances of the close connection between vicious theory and vicious practice. It was alleged that every one of these crimes had been prompted or applauded by Roman Catholic divines. The letters which Everard Digby wrote in Lemon Juice from the Tower to his wife had recently been published and were often quoted. He was a scholar and a gentleman, upright in all ordinary dealings and strongly impressed with a sense of duty to God. Yet he had been deeply concerned in the plot for blowing up king, lord, and commons, and had, on the brink of eternity, declared that it was incomprehensible to him how any Roman Catholic should think such a design sinful. The inference popularly drawn from these things was that, however fair the general character of a papist might be, there was no excess of fraud or cruelty of which he was not capable, when the safety and honor of his church were at stake. The extraordinary success of the fables of Oates is to be chiefly ascribed to the prevalence of this opinion. It was to no purpose that the accused Roman Catholic appealed to the integrity, humanity, and loyalty which he had shown through the whole course of his life. It was to no purpose that he called crowds of respectable witnesses of his own persuasion to contradict monstrous romances invented by the most infamous of mankind. It was to no purpose that, with a halter round his neck, he invoked on himself the whole vengeance of the God before whom, in a few moments, he must appear, if he had been guilty of meditating any ill to his prince or to his Protestant fellow-countrymen. The evidence which he produced in his favor proved only how little popish oaths were worth. His very virtues raised a presumption of his guilt. That he had before him death and judgment in immediate prospect only made it more likely that he would deny what, without injury to the holiest of causes, he could not confess. Among the unhappy men who were convicted of the murder of Godfrey was one Protestant of no high character, Henry Berry, It is a remarkable and well-attested circumstance that Barry's last words did more to shake the credit of the plot than the dying declarations of all the pious and honorable Roman Catholics who underwent the same fate. It was not only by the ignorant populace, it was not only by zealots in whom fanaticism had extinguished all reason and charity, that the Roman Catholic was regarded as a man the very tenderness of whose conscience might make him a false witness, an incendiary, or a murderer, as a man who, where his church was concerned, shrank from no atrocity and could be bound by no oath. If there were in that age two persons inclined by their judgment and by their temper to toleration, those persons were Tillotson and Locke, yet Tillotson, whose indulgence for various kinds of schismatics and heretics brought on him the reproach of heterodoxy, told the House of Commons from the pulpit that it was their duty to make effectual provision against the propagation of a religion more mischievous than irreligion itself, of a religion which demanded from its followers services directly opposed to the first principles of morality. His temper, he truly said, was prone to lenity, but his duty to the community forced him to be, in this one instance, severe. He declared that, in his judgment, pagans who had never heard the name of Christ, and were guided only by the light of nature, were more trustworthy members of civil society than men who had been formed in the schools of the popish casuists. Locke, in that celebrated treatise, in which he labored to show that even the grossest form of idolatry ought not to be prohibited under penal sanctions, contended that the church, which taught men not to keep faith with heretics, had no claim to toleration. End of part 1.